New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing not one, but two media pioneers, Michael Brooks and Phil McKenzie, co-hosts of the podcast Two Dope Boys and, well, a podcast. Both of them have done enough to fuel multiple careers, from consulting with top-ranking government officials to hosting one of the first Information Age conferences. We'll be hearing about all of this and much more during today's chat. Michael, Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. I'm very thrilled to have you. So first, let's start by just giving the audience and myself a little quick, down and dirty version of your story. Get us to today really in a nutshell.
Okay, I'll jump in. Phil McKenzie. I'm a product of Brooklyn, a proud product of Brooklyn. Grew up here all my life. Have done many different things. Went to Howard University, went to Duke University for my MBA. So I have sort of a traditional educational background. Worked at Goldman Sachs for many years as a trader. Got tired of that world for many reasons and left. Then went on to start a men's magazine. I did a creative ad agency, and started Influencer Conference in 2010 as a result of all of that work in culture and influencer spaces. And Influencer Conference is very simply a content platform that brings people together around shared values globally. We produced a conference in New York, London, Berlin, Sao Paulo, and Mumbai. And me and Michael met a couple years ago, and over many conversations and many bottles, decided that we had enough in common and enough interesting things to say to start Two Dope Boys in a podcast. So that's what kind of brought us together.
Fantastic. And our consulting and myriad other ventures. I'm Michael, obviously, Michael Brooks. And I also kind of like Phil in my own way. I think, you know, these atypical biographies for kind of atypical times. So I study international relations at Bates College, actually, and I spent time studying in the Middle East. But before I started my academic journey, I actually co-founded and ran an arts performance platform in Massachusetts, where I grew up. After I graduated, did a variety of things, including doing some strategy and research work on movement building and trend watching. I taught mindfulness meditation briefly, and then ended up becoming a contributor on a show called The Majority Report, which I host on Mondays and is sort of my day gig as a co-anchor. And it's a very policy-heavy show, but also entertainment show, and really is a space in all these new mediums we're talking about, podcasting, YouTube, and all of the rest. So,
You know, I was reading some of the stuff that you guys had written, and one of the things that was really interesting to me is understanding cultural context and as it relates to brands, and whether people can understand, whether brands, big brands, entertainment brands, can understand culture and what that means for them, and how that fits into the work that you're doing and the commentary you're making.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the challenge, that, you know, many brands, they operate based on osmosis and scale, i.e. that they're huge, they can command a certain amount of bandwidth, and they exist merely for the sake of existing. And the challenge is, in a new cultural economy, something that me and Michael think and talk quite a bit about, that's no longer going to work. If you're going to be a brand that survives into the next 50 to 100 years, you have to rethink the way in which you manage to do things. On the surface, many brands are poor at understanding culture, but they can learn how to do that better, but it requires them to sort of release themselves to people who are expert in culture spaces, people like myself and Michael. We've written quite a bit about that. We have a sort of handbook, a short guide called the Cultural Prime Directive that comes out of, for those who are Trekkies and other otherwise nerds would recognize the Prime Directive as the way in which the Federation managed their affairs when dealing with other life forms that they might have encountered. So we kind of took that as the resident blurred of the two of us, black nerd. You know, I kind of thought that that was a cool way of thinking about how brands should sort of operate. You know, they should enter into cultural spaces with the idea of, you know, for example, doing no harm, you know, rather than having a predatory relationship with culture, they should find a way to enable culture without actually interfering with it.
Well, if you're that absolutely makes a lot of sense to me looking at, you know, consumer products or services. The industry I tend to occupy, work in, and work with is entertainment. And so in many ways, entertainment is creating culture, but also trying to work within and understand culture, especially the more traditional media players. So if you're a giant network, what does it mean to you? How do you pay attention to the margin and not find your business entirely disrupted? How can you be aware without being predatory? How do you leverage this insight and bring it into the work that you're doing if you're a network executive?
You know, I think
hire us.
Yeah, that would be a great place to start.
And Gabriella, of course.
That's
we'll all team
right.
up. Yeah.
We're going to form like one super team to bring insights into your network.
Yeah. So just go to our websites right now and we'll see you. Done.
Yes. You know, this is the little tidbit to draw them in.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know, but I think what you're talking about touches on a couple of interesting points. Also kind of drawing back to our cultural prime directive. I think networks, if you're using the traditional sense of networks, they have a time horizon, for example, that's governed by a traditional TV viewing season. You know, if you're the big three, big four, if you include Fox, you're kind of thinking about network seasons from fall to spring and all that kind of stuff. And you need to, you know, one of our second tenet is you have to reevaluate your time horizon. You know, you have to start to think about how do you cultivate talent. You know, we tend to think of like mainstream media as what's in front of the camera, but there's not enough work going on behind the camera. You know, where are you getting your writing staff from? Where are you getting your producers from? Like, how many ideas are you bringing from diverse audiences that have the potential to be really popular?
Well, but are you thinking big enough, I guess, is my question. You know, should it be the traditional sitcom tropes? Does the fall season matter anymore? How should they be telling people about content? Who are they competing against?
I think that that's another. Well, I think it's actually in line with the issue, what Phil said, with what you're raising, because you're talking about part of, you know, sometimes these conversations about the reality that like the faces that we see on television and all the rest need to reflect our, you know, the social reality of America can sound very high-minded, and it is in some ways, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's also the reality of where we are going in terms of demographics and beyond demographics, shared value groups and consumers. So as an example, I think, you know, you're right. Obviously, younger people, certainly myself, I don't have any network loyalty, and none of my consumption is built around any type of primetime programming schedule ever. I look for, you know, I'm creating my own cultural portfolio at all times that cross a lot of idiosyncrasies, which some of which could definitely not be measured if you were doing traditional demographics
right,
or metrics.
Right. Well, story, I think that's how people understand the world around them. There's a great line in 3 Days of the Condor where Cliff Robertson's character, Higgins, says to Robert Redford's Joe Turner, what did you do? And Joe replies, I told them a story.
Right.
And that's sort of that. I always think of that when I think about anything. And even, you know, when we think about brands and they tell stories, and then I think about my son who says, I don't want to listen to a brand story. I'm not interested in their story.
Right.
Which speaks to, you know, they're just never going to be part of his culture you know, he doesn't want them there.
And the lesson is play your position as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think branding, when done well, you don't even notice that you're getting the story. It's just, unfortunately, you know, they kind of hit you over the head with it, and it becomes sort of obvious because it's sort of the model that we've become accustomed to. But when it's seamless, it becomes a little, it comes less easy to distinguish sort of like you're buying in to this story. I think there's certain narratives that people definitely respond to, and one of them is authenticity.
Absolutely. I think authenticity is one of the things that everybody, it's sort of one of the buzzwords, the magic words that everybody is claiming, you know, we're authentic. This is who we are. One of the things I'm curious about, you know, post-internet, it's difficult for a brand to get away, you know, extorting a cultural movement without suffering some sort of public backlash. There's a lot of backlash, can almost be anticipated. It's going to happen. Do you think it's possible that a brand could design a campaign or a piece of marketing with the intention of stimulating backlash?
Yes.
Yes. No question.
I mean, I think they should, you know, potentially, because I guess the broader answer I have is I think that just as our programming is changing so much, and we're in sort of more of an age of, you know, even arguably, like I could say in my limited experience, or, you know, not totally limited, my experience at the Majority Report, which is a very particular world, and Two Dope Boys and podcasting and everything else, like, you have some type of small it's like micro celebrity, if you want to use that word, or some type of terminology where there are certain people that tune into certain channels that follow you. And there's going to be a lot more people like that across platforms. To extrapolate it to brands getting involved in controversy, I think that especially if you're sort of an emergent brand, you are actually going to need to be picking sides in a certain sense and identifying where you are in, if we're being real, what is like a contested culture right now. There's a lot of disagreements. There's a lot of opinions. There's a lot of different ways that people are expressing themselves. And certainly if you want to have any authenticity, you know, I don't think it means you're alienating or adversarial, but you're going to make a claim. And brands have always done that, but I think now it actually needs to go deeper. And by definition, I think in a lot of cases, deeper will be more controversial.
Right, right. So it's like all of the awkward conversations you could have at a work meal, then they're all going to be had for all of the brands.
Yes. Yeah, but you can't be afraid of those conversations.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I always say we have to all get more comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think brands that, to a certain extent, like Wieden and Kennedy had Nike release like a whole statement on their website for Black Lives Matter, like just last week. And, you know, someone can kind of give Nike the side eye potentially maybe, but at the same time, they are speaking directly to their audience. You know, it's like,
right,
that to me is a very authentic message. You know, it's perfectly timed. It's speaking in the voice of those who care, you know, and it doesn't even matter whether they care about Nike in particular, but if there's someone who cares about sneaker culture, and sneaker culture by its very nature is urban and it's global.
But were they one of the only players in that niche to make a statement? Did any other players did any of the other brands make statements?
I don't know what Adidas, Reebok, and Under Armour did. Those would be the next four,
right,
competitors. But I saw the Nike everywhere. So
yeah,
if the others did do something, it wasn't as effective. It could have been just as heartfelt, but I didn't see it. And I saw the Nike thing like all day, every day.
And I mean, not to sound presumptuous, but like if the other ones did, I mean, I kind of think we would know.
Yeah, I think I would have seen it.
I mean, it would be in the, yeah.
You know, but does it, like, you know, I could have missed it. But like I said, if they did it and I didn't see it, it probably wasn't as effective.
Right.
Well,
right.
I got a lot of Nike heads in my world. That
well,
could be.
No, I mean, it's interesting because certainly sneakers are important to my boys, and it's interesting, you know.
Yeah, sneakers, but sneakers are important to everybody.
Right.
That's like sneakers are one of those things now. It's no longer street culture. Street sneakers are everywhere. Like you going into boardrooms and cats have on sneakers. You know, like it's when I walk into a room and I see shoes, I'm like, wow. You still do that?
We're not walking in the same boardrooms then, I think.
Yeah.
I'm in the land of shoes.
Yeah. In the land of shoes.
We operate in the land of sneakers.
Bring me to the land of sneakers.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to the land. You sound like a perfect candidate for the land of sneakers. Shocked that you're not already there.
Well, I'm in flip flops, so you know.
Oh, right? Even better.
Oh, there you go.
But I have to take my shoes when I go to the land of shoes. So what about millennials? That's a very popular demographic. Everybody likes to slice and dice by. My question is, does it really even matter? I mean, should we be targeting by age anymore? Is that relevant?
Nah. We're firmly what we call post-demographics. You know, we don't believe that demographics really matter all that much. You know, again, this is one of our brand positions that, you know, we live in a world where it's about your values. You know, it doesn't matter anymore about, you know, what city you live in or where you're from or your age group. Like so many of those things are now so cross-sectional that it's, in my estimation, almost impossible to make a good brand decision based on these arbitrary numbers of 18 to 24 and 25 to 35 and whatever, however they break those all out, it doesn't seem to be an effective way to manage your brand. And actually, we've done some research on this where we found from a values proposition, like millennials and Gen Xers and Gen Y, like when you start to ask people about what's truly important to them, what drives their life decisions, what motivates them, there's almost no difference in what people will say when posed to those questions, you know? So it's almost like the most important things that matter to you are not going to be a function of necessarily your age based on some arbitrary survey somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have been willing and are able to work, you know, like in that framework if need be. But I think that's a very, even if we're doing that, we're pushing away from that because we don't fundamentally buy it.
Right. I think that probably, I mean, demographics are just used as proxies for things. But as tools have become more refined, it's time to move on and use those more refined targeting tools. Although the business with sneaker culture, I mean, that's sort of interesting because it's almost like how much of that becoming a global culture is a function of it being pushed in America and then it becomes internationalized? I mean, is it something that really did spontaneously happen in urban environments around the world?
I think if you go overseas, you find that people want like old kicks, like they want sneakers, like late edition sneakers, so they want like mid 90 Jordans or whatever it is, so they're more like collectors. And here it's about like the latest freshest kick.
Different though. Is it a uniform culture? I mean, just to push back a little bit on that,
I think
if we're looking at trends and behaviors and cultures, and is it a culture if it actually functions really differently from place to place? I mean, although the object that's fetishized is consistent, the practice around it is radically different. So is it a uniform culture or not?
Well, I don't think culture is ever really uniform in that respect. Right. You know, if I think of something like hip hop or really any kind of music, like it's always going to be different from one place to another. Like you can love rock and still love like different aspects of it, but kind of love the music as a form. And I think sneakers kind of fall into that category. So I don't think you have to have a uniformity in like my perspective being living in Brooklyn and someone else's perspective somewhere else. You know, it's all about us recognizing certain signifiers. And I think when Michael talked about like subtrends, I think the base level would be like, okay, it's an object and it's a sneaker. But the subtrends would be the connectivity behind, well, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean for me as a former Wall Street guy to no longer have to wear that uniform of a standard kind of shoe? So when I go into a meeting with a creative agency or a brand and I see someone else there and they're dressed the same way, we're kind of speaking to each other in a particular manner.
I would just add just a sort of interesting tangent on top of that, which is somewhat connected to sneaker culture. Another thing, we had a conversation once that was, it was actually on Bevel, the razor, but then that expanded to this research that came out of Georgetown about how essentially when brands or just, you know, culture was projected through quote unquote urban culture internationally, scores for the United States went up. So in other words, if you're polling what, you know, kids in Kuwait or China, how they perceive the United States, if, you know, like to be blunt, like if our foreign policy is on their mind, they don't like us so much. But if Wiz Khalifa is on their mind, they like us a lot.
That's
and, you know, the sort of the conversation and, you know, for brands was obviously like, okay, so if, you know, you want to sell more Coke internationally, you got to keep, you know, talking to rappers. But the where Phil and I took it is that, you know, this has implications for, you know, counterterrorism. It says a lot about our soft power. And then that actually loops back to a conversation about policing, about income inequality, about Black Lives Matter, because in fact, some of the most powerful agents for representing brand USA, because the United States is also a brand, obviously, are some of the very people operating on those margins who are actually quite abused and oppressed in our system as it's constituted today. So,
it also cycles back. I know we're, you know, running tight on time, but it cycles back to entertainment and pulling it back so that if you're dealing with content and pushing content, you know, that's one of our chief exports really is entertainment,
right?
You know, and pushing content and the brand and that entertainment, whether it's musical entertainment or it's programming entertainment, and that's another way that that's another part of our soft power globally. Yeah. And that, though, you know, if you're again a media person and you're talking about targeting, you know, how do you get people to discover your content? How do you get them to pay attention? How do you become part of the cultural conversation? It may not be the big hit Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Everybody's tuning in because that's where we're going to get our news today. But there's still some reverb, you know. People talk about, you know, Cersei Lannister and separation of church and state, and they know what I mean, you know.
And that's yeah. And that's why that show is really, I mean, Phil can attest, because I'm like a contrarian, as I guess both of us are. So I was like the dude for a long time. Like, I never hated Game of Thrones, but I was always like, all right, it's not that good. But I've had to even recently I've had to be like, oh, you know what? It is that good.
But and I think Game of Thrones, that was a good example to talk about those subcultures that,
yes.
You know, this is a book that was, you know, a series of books, except for the most recent two, they're written in the 90s. Like,
right.
I read those books years and years before they were even thought of being an HBO show. So to a certain extent, you give HBO the credit for, you know, creating the production and doing it all. But when Game of Thrones was announced, I was like, this is going to be a hit. It has a built-in audience, and you're going to bring the uninitiated into something that's great.
Oh, and what about Silicon Valley? That's awesome.
I love it. I think it's hysterical. I don't know if it's like a game change hit, but it's funny.
Vice Principals, that looks like it's going to be hilarious.
Yeah, but HBO has a different model. Like, HBO can't do something that we think is like, oh yeah, that's pretty funny. Like, they need awards. Their entire model is based on us thinking that you can't miss it.
The Murder Show will win awards.
The Murder Show. That
definitely. That's going to win some awards, no doubt.
I think their economic model works off movies. I think probably something like 70% of their viewers are actually watching their films, but the reason they are still part of the conversation is their programming, and that's what everybody talks about, but the bread and butter is the films. That's just my...
Wow. Who are those people?
Their long tail is hurting. Like, I've said this for a long time. Like, HBO has a lot of shows that people talk about. Like, they're sort of like intellectual conversations, but they're not hits, you know? And right now I look at their bench and I'm like,
Well, their development guy did just leave, so
yeah,
he's invited to leave, I believe, actually.
Still makes Phil talk like Trump. It was a mess.
Yeah,
disaster. I mean, look, frankly, it's pathetic.
Things coming.
People predict that after The Sopranos, everybody said the same thing. I think that HBO is in the game. I think that they're about telling stories and giving people the opportunity to tell stories. I think what's happened, though, is that other networks are also in the game of inviting new voices to tell stories. It may not be the big traditional networks, but you look at FX, you look at Amazon.
FX has done some impressive things. FX, like, don't sleep on FX.
Yeah,
absolutely. And also, you know, TNT has some great shows coming up. I mean, really, there's a lot of great programming out there. The question is, how do people discover it? How does it find its audience?
Through the cultural prime directive.
There you go. We come full circle. You know, I've gone 3 minutes and 22 seconds beyond when I promised I would let you go.
That's fine.
Yeah, it's all good.
It's great talking with you.
Fantastic to talk to you. Can I have one more question? One last wrap it up?
Yes, and then we'll shamelessly plug where they can find us.
Okay. Yeah. My question is, what's up next for you guys? What do you think is... the next big thing that's going to happen
for us individually, or like me, myself, tonight?
I don't want to go there. Okay. I think that's a little too much information.
I'll go Trump again. I mean, look, Gabrielle, it's going to be fantastic. To be completely honest with you, it's going to be tremendous. It would, people may actually get sick of how great it is.
Well done.
But I guess
you mean like bigger picture?
Bigger
in
picture,
the globe?
Please, yes.
Okay. All right, go, Phil.
Wow, I think, you know, we're continuing to grow the show. So we have amazing guests lined up. Like, I'm super excited about our next few months because we book way in advance.
We really do.
Happy about the way the guest calendar is looking. And, you know, people respond to the show. They like, you know, where we're coming from. I think there's a message in the things we're saying that folks are responding to. So obviously we're going to continue to grow and build on that momentum for the future. We're big believers in content, as I'm sure you are as well. Michael mentioned our consulting practice. So we work a lot with brands and people who are interested in these spaces to kind of help them be better at understanding culture and how it impacts their business, and really looking at that long tail, changing their time horizon, getting them out of that Wall Street model of quarter to quarter. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of projects in that space coming up. We're working on a book, me and Michael, as well. So there's a lot of things. The future is bright.
Well, fantastic. I've chewed up way too much of your time, so thank you so much for talking with me. Really appreciate it.
Throw real quick, like, where people can find us and everything?
Yes, do that.
Okay. So the website is 2DopeBoysPod, and that's spelled out fully, 2DopeBoysPod. And that's where you can find, like, actually Phil and I's bios. You can find, we have a crew who are rotating guest hosts of about six people. We have a show on Tuesday and Thursday. Thursday is an On Point show where we interview people like Grant McCracken or Malik Yoba or Matt FX, a lot of really interesting people. Having Rana Farrar on soon, which I'm really excited about. And then on Tuesday, Phil and I host it. We have a rotating co-host, basically. And these are, you know, journalists, strategists, really interesting people. And then on iTunes, it's 2 Dope Boys in a Podcast. That's not spelled out, though. That's the number 2. 2 Dope Boys in a Podcast. Just hit subscribe. And then on Stitcher, 2 Dope Boys in a Podcast. We're also available on Stitcher. So for any of your mobile devices, however you need it, we are available. So please check us out and join the journey with us.
Fantastic. Thank you guys so much.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, guys.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few people who have been important to bringing this program to life. First and foremost, thank you to today's guests, Michael Brooks and Phil McKenzie. What a great interview. Thank you to my friend Rob Naughton for the voice introduction. Thank you to our production team over at Microfame Media. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of my amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.